most of my talk today will be about CMB's probe of new physics, which is beyond the standard model of particles in cosmology. So I'll tell you about my work on cosmic wave fringes that I've done with Mark and a bunch of other people at Caltech. But at the very end, I also want to, I made a little appendix to this presentation where I want to show you some extensions of this work where we use basically the same CMB analysis and formalism to probe something completely different, so to put constraints on cosmic reionization. So I'll talk about cosmic reionization at the very end as well. And if you have questions, just interrupt me, because I might not see a raised hand. And also, can you see, can you turn down the lights, Tim? Do you see the screen now?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you see the laser pointer? Okay, great. That's good. So you won't see me the whole time, but I'm here talking. All right, so before I begin, just a moment of brief reflection of how special the CMB data set is. So not only that the CMB light is the oldest light we observe today, it bears inference from the epoch of inflation of very early times, but it also traveled through all later stages in the evolution of the universe. So it bears imprints about all the astrophysical processes that happened on the way to the observer. And one of such processes is this postulated effect of cosmic birefringence. And Tim, we don't see the top of the screen.
Yes, they do.
Can they?
Yes.
Okay. For some reason, I don't see the whole slide. Do you see the words cosmic birefringence?
No.
Yep, they can't see the top of it. Sorry, just a second.
What is wrong? Why is this? Shoot.
Is there any way we can turn the volume down on this side just a tiny bit?
Is there any way we can turn the volume down on this side?
Anyway, it's fine. It's just quite.
You guys are
you
too
also
young.
Maybe at the focal point of the cone of sound.
No, I understand how most people feel.
So I'm going to continue without the tops of my slides. So here, let me first tell you what cosmic birefringence, what I mean by cosmic birefringence. So we define cosmic birefringence as, I can also speak a little less loud, if that helps. So cosmic birefringence is a rotation of linear polarization of photons that travel cosmological distances. So at the source, you start off with one direction of the polarization plane, and then as you travel through cosmic cosmological distances, you end up rotating by some amount alpha on the way to the observer. And so to try to motivate why you would care, why you should care about such an effect, such postulated effect, imagine you have a scalar field So imagine you have a scalar field that has a slow time evolution. It has some potential V of phi, and it's slowly rolling down this potential. Now, if you have a standard kinetic term, then the equation of state parameter W is defined in this way. And when I say slow roll, this is basically what I mean. So I mean that the kinetic term is negligible in compared to the potential energy, and the equation of state parameter goes to minus one. So if this component dominates the energy density of the universe, then such component causes accelerated expansion of the universe. And we've had at least two instances in the history of the universe when we know the universe expanded at an accelerated rate. One was the inflation, and the other one is today, when this dark energy component dominates the energy density of the universe. So one way to model dark energy, one popular way that people talk about, is to assume that it's composed of this quintessence scalar field phi, slowly rolling down some potential V of phi. And for concreteness, you can perhaps imagine something like a Sudermann-Boltzmann boson, where you have this Mexican hat potential, and the mode that goes around the rim of the hat is this quintessence field. All right, but if you do introduce a new scalar degree of freedom, then you can write down its Lagrangian, you have some standard kinetic term, you have the potential term, but then this thing can also couple to particles from the, to standard model particles, so it can interact with the standard model, and it better not do so much, too much, because we have pretty strong constraints on the phenomenology of the standard model from all sorts of lab experiments. All right, so now, without really motivating this result, let me just tell you that if you require the easiest way to obtain slow roll, to ensure a sustained slow roll, is to invoke shift symmetry, is to require this field respect shift symmetry. And if you do so, then the only dimension 5 gauge invariant coupling that scalar, pseudo scalar field phi can have to the standard model is a coupling to this pseudo scalar electromagnetism, to the FFT, the Chern-Simons term of electromagnetism. This is the result that Sean Carroll and others showed in the 90s. So in other words, if you add a new scalar degree of freedom, but it requests to have shift symmetry so it can slowly roll for a long period of time, then this kind of coupling is sort of a generic feature of such quintessence models. And now, the field-specific phenomenology. So what this coupling does is it modifies the standard Lagrangian of electromagnetism. And if you rederive your Maxwell's equations where you have, where you added this coupling, you will see that there is now a phase difference between left and right-handed polarizations of photons. The net effect is that the photons that propagate through this quintessence field through vacuum, which is now a polarized medium in this sense, will rotate by some amount alpha. And that angle of rotation will be proportional to the total change of the field phi, so how much the field evolved from the source to the observer. And then there's this mass scale from this coupling, basically the strength of the coupling here on the bottom. So this is the picture. So if you start at some time with this directional polarization, field starts from some value of the potential energy, and then as the field rolls, the photons propagate cosmological distances, you end up with some rotated polarization at the position of the observer. And that amount of rotation corresponds to the total evolution of the field along the line of sight. So in other words, what I'm telling you here is that if you do invoke quintessence as a candidate for dark energy, there's this generic feature of these models that's also providing a handle, one of the rare avenues to probe microphysics of dark energy potentially, should we be able to detect such rotation. Now, in order to look for birefringent rotation, we need a source at a cosmological distance that we know the polarization of at the source, and then we need to be able to measure the polarization today, and then the comparison between what we see today and what we know was there to begin with can tell us about whether there was any rotation on the way. And one such source is the CMB. So for the cosmic microwave background, we measure temperature fluctuations, shown these different color fluctuations, and the temperature field is a function of the position of the sky n, direction of the sky n, usually decomposed in terms of these spherical harmonics, which are just the orthonormal basis for functions on a sphere. TLMs here are the coefficients in this decomposition, and the power spectra are defined the usual way as the variance in this Fourier space. But besides from the temperature, we also measure polarization. And the polarization of this picture, I don't know if you can see, is denoted with these white lines. So the direction of polarization in every point in the sky is also measured. Yes?
Can we quickly experiment with turning the lights
that better?
What is your opinion about whether
that's better?
Yeah, it's a slightly better, actually.
It's slightly better? Okay. All right. So polarization field, defined in the usual way in terms of the Stokes parameters, Q and U, can be decomposed in terms of spin 2 spherical harmonics. The polarization is a spin 2 field on the sphere. And there are two distinct coefficients in this composition, and these are the E modes and the B modes. And the E mode polarization, or the gradient component, the polarization pattern that represents an E mode looks something like this. It's parity even. And the B mode, on the other hand, has handedness. So it's a polarization pattern that looks something like this. All right, now, if we start with some polarization primordially, some polarization pattern that can be described like this primordially, and if you then rotate polarization direction in every point in the sky by an amount that's direction dependent, so in principle, the rotation angle can be direction dependent, then what you end up doing is mixing the original Q and U Stokes parameters so that the new ones that you observe today represent some combinations of the primordial ones. And if you think about it in terms of E and B modes, if you start with a pure E mode and then you rotate each one of these directions by some amount alpha, you end up with some pattern that's no longer a pure E mode. It's some combination of an E mode and a B mode. And this new induced B mode will be proportional to the original E mode that you had primordially, in a sense, and to the amount of rotation that you had. So what I'm saying here is that rotation essentially induces B modes, and so it changes the statistics of the CMB. It changes all the polarization-related power spectra and cross-correlations in the CMB. So in other words, it modifies the EB, TB, E, and TE cross-correlations. Those cross-correlations can all be used to reconstruct the amount of rotation alpha. And specifically, a characteristic signature of this rotation is that it produces EB and TB cross-correlations. So it produces these parity-violating cross-correlations. Where the standard picture, when you don't have rotation, the EB and TB power spectra vanish. And then also, there are no off-diagonal cross-correlations to first order between different Fourier modes, between L and L prime, that are not the same. So there are these delta functions. So that's the standard picture. If you have rotation, this is no longer true. So if you have uniform rotation, then EB and TB power spectra are non-zero. So they're a signature of potentially of some rotation that happened on the way. And then also, there's a bunch of these off-diagonal cross-correlations between E and B modes, and similarly between the temperature and the B modes in the CMB maps. So those off-diagonal correlations is what we are focusing on in this work. So previous work has constrained the uniform rotation from cosmic birefringence to be less than about a degree. And the quantity that I'm after here is the power spectrum of the fluctuations of the rotation angle alpha. So if alpha is a function of the position of the sky, then you can decompose it in terms of spherical harmonics, like you do for the temperature. And you can define the power spectrum in the usual way. And so this is the quantity that I'm focusing on. Now, the reason to look for direction-dependent rotation is, first of all, why not? Because if the field phi that's driving this rotation has fluctuations, which it will have if it's a dynamical field, then that will reflect in the fluctuations in the field alpha as well. And then also looking for fluctuations in alpha can increase the sensitivity to look for the signal, for birefringent signal. Furthermore, it allows you to consider models that don't have uniform rotation, and the only way to look for the signal is to look for fluctuations. And then eventually, if we do detect birefringent rotation, the exact shape of this power spectrum CL alpha can help discern underlying models.
Can
All right, so let me move on. Yep.
How do you tell the difference between this and the same signal that you get from lensing? Because lensing also tends to be into B.
Yes. So lensing also induces... So I think the question was, how do you discern this from the lensing signal?
Yeah.
And the answer to that is this, the EB cross-correlation, or the B modes that the rotation induces, are of different parity, of opposite parity, than those that are induced by the lensing potential. So the TB cross-correlations, the alpha modes, or let me put it this way, to reconstruct the modes of the rotation angle alpha, you use different pairs, different Fourier modes, different pairs of Fourier modes in temperature and polarization than you do for the lensing. So these really don't bias each other.
I was also wondering if you could comment on models where you can calculate what the power spectrum should be, because I would imagine for a single field quintessence model, there wouldn't be very strong fluctuations in the
value. Most of the signal will be at low else. Yeah, so if you consider something that picked up, I'm sorry, correct me if I'm not answering the right question, because I can partially hear you. So you're asking, wouldn't most of the, basically, would the fluctuations be suppressed in comparison to the uniform rotation for most of the models? And I think the answer to that is that most of the signal, if you have something like a scaling invariant power spectrum for the fluctuations in phi, you will have something very similar to a scale invariant power spectrum for the fluctuations in alpha, and most of the signal will come from L's below 10 or so. But you do pick up something like 50% or 40-50% if you go below L of 0.
But is there a specific model where CL has an interesting amplitude, or what models would give a CL that has a large amplitude for alpha?
I'm not very familiar with different quintessence models, especially in the context of translating, you know, the power spectrum of phi into the power spectrum of alpha. So I don't know if there are exotic models that give you a large signal at higher L's or something like that. So I can't answer that question. But in principle, you can, whatever model of phi you have, you can figure out what the power spectrum of alpha should look like. I don't know if I answered that entirely. Okay. All right. So I'll move on to the formalism now. Hopefully you can see the formula here. So I'll parse out all the formulas that I'm showing. It will be a little bit formula heavy, but I'll explain every bit of it. So this is, I said that the rotation alpha, and this is again modes of alpha in spherical harmonic modes of alpha. So alpha induces TB cross-correlations, and it specifically cross-correlates L and L prime modes that are not the same. So it induces these off-diagonal cross-correlations. So there are no delta functions here. And this is how TB induced by the rotation of primordial E modes looks like. These are a bunch of spin two spherical harmonics, and this is the parity. The parity requirement here for the LL prime modes. You'll see that there is a restriction on which LL prime modes, which Fourier modes of temperature polarization contribute to a given rotation capital L mode. This is opposite for the lensing, for this class about the lensing. All right, so in this equation, here is the theory. So this tilde denotes primordial power spectrum. So this is, by putting this in here, I'm saying that I know what was there primordially. So this is a primordial TE power spectrum before any rotation. This cross-correlation measured from the data maps. So TB is measured from the data maps. And this is what I want to know. So I want to reconstruct every mode of alpha. So if I invert this equation, this is how an estimator for alpha 11 hat stands for the estimator looks like. So there's some normalization here. And there are two distinct components, so let me explain what they are. So here, I'm calculating the BLM mode from the CMB maps, and then transforming it back using this spin-2 spherical harmonic, transforming it back into pixel space. So this component here is just a map of B modes, essentially. But on the other hand, this other component is, so TLM, TL prime and prime, are measured from the CMD maps, but then they don't transform them back into pixel space using the spin zero spherical harmonics, but rather spin two spherical harmonic. So this thing here, you can think of something like the curvature, a second derivative of the temperature field in pixel space. So I take this curvature temperature, cross-correlate it with the B mode map, and then see how that varies as a function of position in the sky to go back to Fourier space. And that's how I reconstruct alpha. Okay, now you'll notice that I have barred quantities here, B LM bar and T LM bar. And that's because, as I said before, there are many LL prime combinations that I can, LL prime pairs that I can measure from the CMD maps. And each one of them can give me an estimate of alpha at any given capital level, so of any given rotation mode that satisfies this condition. So I need a way to combine all those pairs in order to reconstruct an optimal estimator for alpha. And the way to do that is by reconstructing this minimum variance estimator, where I take the B mode from the map, and then I weigh down by the variance that I expect there to be primordially just from the CMB fluctuations and also from the instrumental noise. So every mode is weighed down by the variance that should be there intrinsically in the maps, so that the combined estimate is the maximum, is the minimum variance estimate of the rotation angle. So these are this is the inverse variance filtering scheme that we apply, where this map under quotation marks just means that I actually calculated this power spectrum analytically by adding the primordial BV power spectrum to the BV power spectrum that that's generated by the instrumental noise appropriate for the instrument that I'm using. So this is analytic inverse variance filter that we are using here. Okay, and then there's a correction also within it for the resolution of the instrument, so some sort of window function for that. So this is a general prescription, and I'm here focusing only on the, you notice, on the TB estimator for alpha, and that's because TB is the cross-correlation that gives the best sensitivity for the WMAP noise levels. Eventually, for Planck and so on, the EB will win over the TB, but for now, I'm focusing only on the TB. Okay, so just to flash the complete formulas in front of you, so this is minimum variance estimator for alpha. As I said, I sum over all LL prime estimates. So from I sum all the estimates for alpha x capital L mode, but weigh down by their variance. So that I get the minimum variance estimator, and then you have to normalize it appropriately, as is just the expression for the normalization. All right, once you get the estimates for any alpha LM mode, then you can estimate what the power spectrum of alpha is. And this is the usual expression for the power spectrum estimator from the measured alpha LM modes. So we can't really take the mean overall realizations of the CMB sky, so we have to take the mean overall M modes for any given L. And this F sky factor just corrects for the fact that even though I'm claiming here that I'm using full sky formalism and that I'm really using whole maps of the CMB, I need to cover the galactic plane. So I'm effectively chopping out about 30% of the sky. And so I need to correct all the variances for that factor here. So this is the estimator for the rotation angle power spectrum. And if you remember that every alpha LM mode was constructed from a pair, BT pair like this, then this autocorrelation alpha alpha will be a four-point correlation function of this form schematically. And that quantity does not vanish even if I have no rotation from birefringence at all. And the reason for that is that there is this noise bias component besides from the signal. So I really want to reconstruct the signal, So I need to figure out what the noise bias here is. The noise bias comes from the fact that even if you don't have any rotation, you still have these Gaussian contractions because you have the primordial fluctuations, BB and TT, and you also have sky cuts, so you have some TB-TB contributions and so on. So mainly sky cuts and the CMB itself contribute to this noise bias. And other things like inhomogeneous noise in the CMB maps and so on. So in order to recover the signal, the estimate of the signal, I take this estimate of alpha, calculated of CL of alpha calculated this way, and then I subtract this whole thing, which is this noise bias shown above, and I do so in a two-step procedure. First, I subtract this isotropic bias that's calculated from the data, and that's just to say that I take out these Gaussian contractions from this sum, from the entire four-point correlation. And then in addition to that, I also do a small correction where I subtract this additional source of noise bias that mainly comes from the sky cuts. The way that's calculated is if you simulate the CMB maps, you apply masks, analysis masks the same way like for the data, then you can correct them for this isotropic bias specific to a given realization of the CMB sky. And then whatever bias is left on average from any simulations, that comes from the sky cuts and other things that we want to subtract from the power spectrum calculated from the data as well. Okay. So this is just a brief description of the data we're using. So I've used foreground reduced WMAP maps, WMAP 7 maps from three frequency bands at the highest resolution, both temperature and polarization, temperature shown here. And then I also use analysis masks that cover the galaxy. Again, I don't know if you can really, can you see these pictures? Well, okay. Yeah, okay. So we use the standard analysis masks that are available on WMAP legacy website to mask out the galaxy in temperature and polarization. Then we also run a bunch of simulations, and there are two reasons that I run the simulations. One is to figure out the error bars on each measurement of CL alpha alpha. And the other one is, as I said before, to debias my measurements using the procedure that I described two slides ago. Those simulations contain realizations of the CND with a fixed cosmology, best fit WMAP 7 cosmology. They also contain inhomogeneous noise and correlations between Q and U parameters, symmetric beams, so they take into account the resolution of the instrument and so on. And we mask these simulated CMB skies in the same way that we mask the data. And just before I show you the results, let me just show you one of our test runs. So here I've done a bunch of simulations where I've rotated the CMB sky using a scaling invariant power spectrum, so some power spectrum for CL alpha alpha shown here in black thin line. Red thick line or the blue dash. And then I recovered this power spectrum from the simulations applying this this analysis method that I described, exact same way that I applied it to the data, and I get the recovered measured alpha-alpha power spectrum shown in black. So there's a pretty good agreement, so we recovered the signal pretty well, and that's a reassurance that this method works well. The gray area is the one sigma from a number of simulations that I use. So these are means from something like there are 400 simulations. Okay. So these are measurements from the data. This is a measurement calculated just from the V frequency band. So all the correlations all the temperature and polarization maps are taken from the V-band, and this is the biased power spectrum. So this is before debiasing. The black wiggly line is the power spectrum before debiasing. The line that you've, I don't know how well you can see it, but that lies basically almost exactly on top of it, the blue dashed line, is this isotropic bias, this large correction bias that I was talking about, that comes mainly from the CMB fluctuations and the instrumental noise. And then in addition to that, there's a small correction for the sky cuts that's not visible on this plot. So this is the measurement of the bias power spectrum from the V-band. If you do the same measurement by where you use the, where you cross-correlate the W-band and the V-band, then you end up with the bias power spectrum that looks like this. It's still, it wiggles pretty much around zero. So you basically, by cross-correlating different frequency bands, you get rid of most of your bias. And the reason for that is because the noise, which is the largest contribution to the bias, is mostly uncorrelated between different frequency bands. So you can really use any combination of the frequency bands to do the measurement. And here is the debiased power spectrum. So the top panel shows the debiased alpha-alpha power spectrum for this cross-correlation of W and V frequency bands with 1 and 2 sigma confidence level intervals calculated from the null simulations of the CMB sky. The bottom panel is just a bit version of the top with 1 sigma error bars. So in other words, we recover consistency with zero for CL alpha alpha modes all the way from uniform rotation to the resolution of the WMAP instrument, which is about 512, L512, which corresponds to something like 20 arc minutes scales in the sky. So this is the key point slide. And now you can ask about how reliable these error bars are that we recover from our simulations. And just to make sure that things like unresolved point sources and also foregrounds and foreground residuals don't impact our results, and that they don't impact the estimates of the error bars, we did two tests. So on both panels, the black data points and error bars are the fiducial ones that I showed in the previous slide. So these are from the data that's masked with the fiducial analysis masks and so on. To estimate the impact of unresolved point sources, those the resolved point sources are masked. But those that we can't resolve, we can mask them out. So to estimate what the contribution of those can be at most, what we did is we unmasked on all the known point sources, so even the brightest ones, and then we reapply the same analysis method, and the red points are the measurements that are recovered in that way. And you see that even if you allow for the maximal possible contribution from the point sources, the measurements are still consistent, and there is no overall bias that's induced. So point sources probably don't impact our measurements in the error bars very much. It's a similar story with the foregrounds and foreground residuals, but the tests that we did here are the following. So for the red bits, we've used an extended analysis mask. So we've extended the mask and masked the galaxy to cover more of the area around the galactic plane, about 30% more. And again, there's no overall bias, and the measurements are still consistent within 1 sigma. And we did a similar thing where we repeated the analysis, but prior to foreground subtraction. So we've done the whole analysis with a standard analysis mask, but without subtracting the foregrounds. And those are the green crosses here. Pretty much lie on top of the black dots. Again, consistent measurements. So in that sense, yes?
I can't see because the resolution is too low, but what are the units on the vertical axis for the power spectrum?
Degrees squared.
Okay.
Are there any other questions to this point?
These are the actual data where you've, in the left, taken out the mask from the point sources. But this is a simulation, because you said on the previous slide that it was simulations. But is this the real data?
No, these are actual. No, so both previous slide was, let me go back up one. So this is the actual measurement from the WMAP data.
Okay.
The error bars are estimated from null simulations. And that's the case here as well.
Okay.
So all the data that I'm, all the data points here are derived from WMAP maps using the variation of the analysis masks.
Okay.
But the error bars are derived from the simulations.
Did you try running your analysis on the fake maps that the WMAP collaboration provides on the Lambda website that include the point sources and foregrounds?
On the, sorry, can you say that again? On the maps, the WMAP collaboration provides for what?
The end-to-end simulation that they have, which is a fake, purely Gaussian CMB, but has estimates for the point sources and foregrounds and whatnot.
Oh, you mean the simulations of the CMB with the foregrounds added. So they had a limited number of those. They had like just several as far as I know, and I talked to WMAP people about that, and it wasn't, we sort of converged after that conversation to sort of doing these kind of analysis math tests just to sort of estimate the maximum problem that these foregrounds can represent rather than exactly quantifying. Another way to do this properly would be to include you know, run 1,000 simulations, all with foregrounds, and so on, and then to try to estimate how much they impact the error bars. What I'm saying here is that you should focus on essentially the difference between the data points and notice that it's less than my one sigma estimate, and that's sort of a maximal amount that foreground residuals can scrub the measurements, essentially. But it's not a quantitatively very precise statement. It's more of a statement that that contribution is very subdominant to the error bars that we have just from the instrumental noise. So no, I haven't delved into the few simulations that they have there. I haven't done that, no.
Okay. So,
all right, no, I'm sorry.
I have another question. Have you multiplied this by L squared or not? So that's a CL for alpha, not L squared.
No, it's not L. It's just CL alpha alpha.
So the actual angle is like huge because if I wanna look at one of those data points, I have to multiply it by L squared to get a number, and I don't know, at L of 200, it's gonna be, I don't know.
To get the RMS fluctuation on a given scale or something like that?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, you do.
So it's going to be like 1,000 degrees or something like that. Isn't that right?
Oh, so if you, yes. So if you were to take, sorry, if you wanted to fit to these error bars a flat line, for example,
mm-hmm.
You know, like if you were to interpret this as, oh, this means that the RMS that's allowed is the one that would be allowed with a flat power spectrum that just doesn't exceed these data point error bars, that would be wrong way to interpret this for various reasons. One is that we have constraints on just the RMS fluctuation just from the TE power spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, less than something like, at the resolution of this one, less than something like 9 degrees or something like that. So there is that constraint. And the other thing is that everything that I've done here, where I claim that this measurement is the CL alpha alpha autocorrelation, I assume the small angle rotation. So I assume that in every pixel, the alpha is a small number. If you don't assume that, the whole formalism thing that I showed you before applies, but then this quantity is not really CL alpha alpha. It's rather a correlation of something like an autocorrelation of quantity that's one half sine to alpha or something like that. So I've done the small angle approximation when I'm telling you that this is a constraint in CL alpha. So you can interpret these constraints as a constraint on any amount of rotation, any amount of RMS, like the large ones that you're mentioning, you can fit in here. But then you have to be careful as to what is the quantity that you're constraining.
Yeah, that's very puzzling because, of course, sine of alpha doesn't get bigger than 1. But if I multiply ls squared by this C sub l, it can get huge. So I'm not sure. Does it mean that there's a theoretical prior that, there's an upper limit just based on the definition on how big this can be? I guess that's what it means, right?
I suppose, but I'm not sure I'm understanding what you're saying.
So you're saying, so there's a maximum to this quantity, which is sine alpha, which is 1, basically. So you're saying the field that you're constraining cannot be bigger than 1 because it's sine of alpha over 2 or something like that. So.
Yeah, I guess that's probably a way to think about it, yeah.
And that already puts a constraint on, but I wonder whether that's stronger than the errors that you have.
Part of what I was saying is that, again, you have a constraint on the RMS rotation at the pixel size, you know, pixel scale level, just from the T power spectrum, which tells you the RMS is less than something like 9 degrees. And that is a stronger constraint than a model where you would, you know, put a delta function here or something like that. Okay, but I was going to say next that, you know, again, these error bars and this null measurement can be translated into a constraint, as you pointed out, on any particular model of rotation that you're interested in. And so I've looked at only this fiducial model, scale invariant power spectrum, in this sense, the power spectrum that has some amplitude and goes as 1 over L squared. Yeah?
Oh, sorry, can I just ask one question about the previous slide? Just to maybe to say that I think I'm just saying the IHS question. I'm just trying to say the IHS question again. If I want to ask what is the RMS fluctuation in alpha across, you know, on a scale, on a angular separation corresponding to L, is that basically L squared times CL at that scale?
Yes.
Because that looks quite big. It like for example at L of 300, that looks like it's, you know, the RMS fluctuation going to be it's like L squared times that error bar. If I see the looks like it's bigger than
So this is exactly the point that I was making before, which is that if you allow for that, if you allow for large alpha at any given pixel, at any given point in the sky, then this is not the constraint on the power spectrum of alpha. It's a constraint on this quantity that's 1/2 sine 2 alpha, or something like that. So it's the autocorrelation of that. And if you wanted to calculate what that is, you would have to... So in other words, the constraint, these numbers here, hold as a constraint on the relevant quantity for this rotation angle, but it's not the quantity is not the autocorrelation of the rotation angle. So if you're looking at models that have high signal here, or even the signal that the error bar allows here, you have to take into account that you're not looking at the constraint on the rotation angle, you're really looking at the constraint on this other quantity. Yeah, it's just because I've done the, you know, I've assumed that at every pixel, rotation is small, and then the Taylor expansion for that rotation angle space factor that changes the Q and U parameters, and then derived everything from there.
Or stated another way, if there had been huge fluctuations of order 2 pi fluctuations in the angle on those scales, would you have detected it with these error bars, or would it still be consistent with zero?
I think it would be consistent with zero.
Oh, okay. At these scales, okay.
Okay, more questions? Okay. So I've looked at one specific model for rotation, as I said, the scale invariant model, just as an illustration to see in this case where most of the signal, again, as Ken pointed out, would come from the smallest L's. So given an L detection and given the error bars from the simulations that we have, we can translate the null detection to an upper limit on the CL alpha alpha for a particular model, for this model. And then the constraint that we have translated to this constraint on the amplitude of CL alpha alpha at the quadrupole. So this is C2 alpha alpha, just picked one multiple to demonstrate the amount of rotation that this allows for in a given model. Here on the right, I'm showing just the probability distribution function of the best fit amplitude for this model for a bunch of simulations. And that I did in order just to estimate what the width of this distribution is to get this error bar. Okay, so this is, if you were to summarize the results in one number, that's probably the number you want to remember. Okay, so far with WMAP, at least for uniform rotation, with the TV cross-correlation, we were able to go down to an order of a degree scale of rotation angles. With Planck, we'll be able to go more than an order of magnitude lower using the EB cross-correlation, the measurement of the EB cross-correlation. And then with CMB Pollack experiments, another order of magnitude. On the right-hand side, I'm showing the square root variance of the rotation for any given free mode L. For WMAP, as you can see, the TV does better than the EV. The zero here would correspond to uniform rotation. For Planck, the situation inverses for EV and TV, and again, for CMB fold, the EV does best. Okay, so these are forecasts for the future. So arcminute scale with Planck. And at the end of this birefringent story, I just wanted to mention, again, you don't see the title here, so I'm going to tell you what this picture is about. So as I said, the uniform rotation produces these parity violations in the CMB. So in that sense, you can test new parity violating physics using these off-diagonal TV cross-correlations. But then there are other scenarios that people consider that would also produce these TB and EB power spectra. So other parity violating physics that can be tested with very similar formalism using the CMB. And just as an illustration here, I'm showing that if you have chiral gravitational waves from inflation, so in other words, if you have the contribution from the left and right-handed polarizations of the primordial gravitational waves is not equal, then you end up inducing TB and EB power spectra. So these are no longer vanishing on the surface of Lotz scatter. And just to compare how these power spectra look like as opposed to those induced by the rotation, here the dashed lines represent the TB and EB power spectra from this chiral gravity. And the CB, the birefringence-induced power spectra shown as solid lines in yellow. And you can see just from the shape of the power spectra, you can, at least these two effects are very different, look very different. So the signals look very different from the CMB. So there's hope that if we do detect TB and EB power spectra in the CMB with something like Planck, we'll be able to tell if it's a high signal to noise detection, whether it comes from the birefringent rotation or something like this chiral gravitational waves. Okay, so this is pretty much where I would end the story of cosmic birefringence. So if there are any more questions about this part of the talk, you can ask me now or you can ask me later.
Maybe I'll just ask, are you planning to do the analysis on Planck, or do you know if someone is planning to do the analysis on Planck?
I would like to. Uh-huh. I would like to do the analysis on Planck, and beyond Planck, it would be also interesting to look at these ground-based experiments, these deep surveys from SPT and ACT and so on, because they might. I haven't done the estimates for cut skies, for small portions of the sky available, but this is something that I plan to do in the future. But it's not yet Planck. I'm not yet, you know, I'm not official part of the team or anything like that. That was a part of the question. But yes. I'm not aware that they're planning to do it. I'm not sure. All right. So now, as an extension to this work, I wanted to talk a bit about essentially how you can use the same formalism and basically the same analysis method to look into the signatures from cosmic ionization, not just exotic things like cosmic birefringence. So let me take a few minutes to tell you about that. So what we know about cosmic ionization from theoretical considerations is that it was a very inhomogeneous process. We know that the universe transitioned from neutral to ionized through this process of nucleation of ionized bubbles around the first sources of light in the universe, and these bubbles expanded, eventually coalesced, and filled out the entire volume of the intergalactic medium, turning it completely ionized, as we observe today. The observations of this reionization epoch are very few. What we know is about reionization from observations is that it completed by redshift of 6 or 7, something like that. We also measured the topological depth, tau, to Thomson scattering off of these free electrons in the IGM, all the way to the last scattering surface, measures on the order of 0.1, and we have that from the CMB data. That if reionization was more or less instantaneous, that places it at a redshift of about 10. We also know, as of very recently, maybe about a month ago or so, Edge's experiment reported their first results that puts a lower limit on the duration of reionization process on this transition period of about inertial space of about 0.06. And this experiment was basically looking at this redshifted 21 centimeter signal from the epoch of reionization by looking at the frequency spectrum, low radio frequencies, the whole sky essentially. And from non-detection, they know that this transition wasn't exactly a step function. It had to be smeared out in redshift space by at least this much. And then there are other constraints from SPT and so on that put upper limits on this duration from some specific models of reionization. So this is basically, this more or less summarizes what we know about the reionization process from the observations. But if you think about what this ionized medium does to the CMB, it also changes the statistics of the CMB. So we can use the CMB to probe the epoch of reionization. And Kendrick and a bunch of other people, Accord, working and so on, have done previous work on considering a CMB as a probe of the reionization. And the story goes as follows. If you look at different lines of sight through this ionized medium, looking back to time along different lines of sight, you will see that the integrated ionized fraction is different. It's position dependent. So this optical depth of Thomson scattering varies as a function of the position of the sky. So one way to look for this varying signature of the reionization period in the sky is to look for this effect of patch screening. So the temperature fluctuations, primordial the tilde here, and also polarization fluctuations get screened by e to the minus tau as a function of n. And you'll notice that that phase factor, the patch screening, direction-dependent screening, modifies the polarization in a very similar way that the rotation from birefringence, for example, does. So there's this phase factor. And so you can basically rewrite the whole formalism that I showed you before to show this patch screening induces B modes, that these B modes are correlated with the temperature and polarization E modes, and then you can use these TB cross correlations or EB and so on to try to recover tau, Fourier modes of tau. So tau LM, you can write down the tau LM estimator, very similar as the one for the rotation angle, alpha LM, that I showed before. The difference here is that the modes that contribute to tau are of opposite parity than those that contribute to the rotation. And this has been derived in a paper by Dworkin et al. In 2009, and a bunch of other people looked at it as well. So we decided that since we had the whole machinery set up to evaluate this estimator, we basically changed the parity of our estimators for the rotation angle and we derived the same results. We derived the same results for the CL tau tau power spectrum to constrain the patch screening using the value map set of data. So these are the results. Again, we get consistency with zero at all else up to 512, so down to the resolution of the instrument. There's one caveat to this analysis, which is that the weak lensing contributes to this estimator of CL tau tau. So these are the upper limits, like true upper limits. If you wanted to recover the signal, you would really need to delens the maps using external data sets or using the CME only before you can really find the signal and differentiate from the lensing signal with future data sets. So this is a proof of principle analysis that we've done here. So in order to understand what constraints like this imply for this picture of reionization where you screen the surface of light scatter by different amounts depending on the position of the sky, we've considered this picture where assume that you can describe this patch of screening with a CL tau tau power spectrum given with this expression. What I mean by this expression is I basically assume that that fluctuations, the RMS of the fluctuations in tau, in the optical depth tau, below some coherence scale are given with this delta tau, so you have white noise power spectrum that cuts off at some coherence scale, some given coherence scale on the sky, theta C, that corresponds to a multiple LC on the sky. So I've taken this description of the patch screening and then looked at what kinds of constraints on that picture, on this delta tau RMS of fluctuation of tau as a function of the coherence scale in the sky. So what kinds of constraints on that parameter space do the measurements from WMAP, for example, and future measurements from Planck and CMB Polytech mission provide? So in this case, this is the upper limit that the null detection from WMAP implies. Again, there's lensing mixed into this, so this is a really weak upper limit from the TB cross correlation. In the case of this patch screening, because the patch screening affects the temperature, not just polarization, the TT power spectrum actually does better in reconstructing the signal. And current best constraint on the RMS of tau is on the order of 100%, so on the order of 0.1. It's a really weak constraint. With Planck, we'll be able, these are forecasts for Planck, from the EB cross correlation and then a thin line here from the TT cross correlation and the forecasts for CME Paul. So each time you go by a few orders of magnitude deeper. And now to understand What these constraints imply for the physical properties of the reionization of the IGM, the intergalactic medium during reionization, I've considered a very simple toy model of reionization. So to decide what, you know, part of that parameter space that I was showing you is actually interesting to look into, I've considered this crinkly surface model, where the observer is sitting here in the center looking out, and then reionization surface is this crinkly surface beyond which the universe is neutral, inside is reionized. And I've assumed that the reionization goes through a process of nucleation of these ionized bubbles around the first sources of light in the universe. The bubbles are shown here. And then these bubbles eventually populate the entire IGM, and that's how the ionization completes. Again, it's a toy model that's just supposed to guide the eye, presented to be a realistic representation of what really, with all the details that go on during the ionization process. But the interesting thing in this model is that you get some interesting scaling relations. First of all, there's some mean redshift of reionization z, but then the thickness of this reionization surface in the redshift space I call delta z. And you'll notice if you look at this picture, if you look at different lines of sight out towards the reionization surface, the fluctuation in delta tau, fluctuation in the optical, in the integrated optical, that corresponds to the fluctuation in the redshift when you reionize in a given direction. So the sooner you reionize, the bigger the optical depth to Thomson scattering will be in that direction. So there is that scaling relation in a matter-dominated universe in this simple picture, but then also the fluctuation in redshift can be translated into a physical size if you put reionization at a given redshift. So in other words, the size of the bubbles, RC here, correspond to the coherence scale in the sky, coherence scale of the patchiness of reionization. That physical size corresponds to how much the reionization process is smeared out in redshift. So it corresponds to delta Z again in matter-dominated universe in this simple picture. So at the end of the day, you correlate delta Z with RC and delta tau with delta Z, so you get a relation between the optical depth, RMS fluctuation in the sky, and the size of the bubbles during reionization if you put reionization as redshift of depth. So this is the relation that we get. And so if you look back at this two parameter space, where I have coherence scale on the sky, that coherence scale corresponds up here on top to the size of the bubbles as redshift of 10 in megaparsecs per moving. So those correlate with the RMS fluctuation on the sky in this simple crinkly surface model. And this is the preferred region for this model. I didn't draw a line, but rather a band, just to illustrate the uncertainty within this model, where I haven't taken care of any factors of 2 pi and so on. So this region is supposed to just guide the eye as to if you want bubbles of characteristic size of 75 megaparsecs per second moving, say, then where the RMS fluctuation would be in tau. So what you can see from here is that for example, the EPIC CMB coalition and also Planck, even though they're not probing very small scales, LC, here, they do start to sort of exclude the extreme reionization scenarios where reionization happens through these large characteristic bubble sizes of 30 or 20 megaparsecs moving and larger. The signal from realistic simulations that people run will mostly come from Ls of 3,000, so it will be all the way down here. But again, if there are any surprises as to how reionization process occurred in this sense of the bubble size, CMB Paul and Planck will be able to see something like that. And just for the end, I said that EDGES puts a lower limit on the delta Z duration reionization. In this model, again, that translates to a lower limit on the RMS fluctuation of the sky. So edges includes a whole part of this parameter space, so it limits the amount of the parameter space that you have to look for this. Okay, so here is the summary of organization. So again, I've used the same minimum variance estimator formalism for the cosmic bare fringes, and that I use for cosmic bare fringes, I use it to look at the reionization, to look for this patch screening effect that's been proposed, and the forecasts are for future generations in the experiments are that they should something like 5 and CMB pole will be will start putting interesting constraints on the reionization signal. Okay, so I'll end here and I'll just leave you with this take home few points from both parts of the talk and take any more questions that you have.
Gaussian. Is it totally out of the realm of possibility to estimate, say, the bi spectrum of tau from these sort of observations?
Sorry, can you say that over again? I heard the bi spectrum, and that's about it.
Oh, okay. So the tau field from reionization will be non-Gaussian, most likely.
Okay. Yeah.
Is there any hope of getting at that non-Gaussianity, so maybe the bi-spectrum of tau from these sort of observations?
I don't know. I haven't thought about it. It seems like an interesting question, but I haven't looked into that.
Right.
So I have a question. So I'm a bit lost that when you make a connection between the length of reionization and the size of the bubbles. Because I can imagine that reionization happens completely homogeneously, and so you don't see any bubbles, but still there's a finite redshift during which reionization happens.
Mm-hmm. So let me go back. Okay. So this picture. So it's a very, very naive picture or simple scenario where we don't take into account any growth of bubbles, anything like that. They just need to, essentially, if you think about it, in the sense, they have to sort of pop next to each other in order to populate the IGM, right?
Yes.
So this is, you put tiles on your IGM to cover it up, and that's how you reionize the entire thing, right? So in that sense, this spread of this yellow region is connected to the bubble size. Just from the picture, if you don't think about it mathematically, then the spread will be very close to what the bubble size is for some number of times the bubble size. If you think about it as
I understand what you're saying. So I guess you're assuming that. The ionization is either 0 or 1. And
yes.
I'm saying that it could also be some between the two, right? Between,
yes.
It could be a continuous number.
Yes.
And in principle, it's possible to have no bubbles whatsoever, but it's still ionized universe. So it's, I guess the point is it's a model of the, it's your model that it only happens as bubbles, but it could be completely homogeneous, couldn't it?
Could the ionization be completely homogeneous?
Yeah, couldn't it?
I mean, the simulation, like if you reionize universe by forming these sources of ionizing radiation, right?
Yeah.
So in that sense, and you first ionize, more or less, you first ionize the regions around the sources, and then this ionization front expands around them as you have more and more ionizing radiation, very naively, and then eventually these regions coalesce and more sources pop out in the middle and you populate the entire IGM. So the conventional wisdom is that, from a bunch of simulations people run, is that in that sense this was an inhomogeneous process. It doesn't happen everywhere at the same time, and it doesn't happiness task in every point in the IGM.
It depends on whether the ionization is done by star forming galaxies or by AGNs, for example.
So it's mostly done by stars, essentially.
Okay.
That's the expectation, yeah. But it wouldn't depend, even if you wanted IGNs. I mean, they're not, you know, homogeneous. They're not at every point in the. You have to somehow, you know, push this ionization front out. And whatever snapshot you take in the meantime while you haven't completed it, it's going to be this patchy phase. There's somewhere, at some point, there's going to be this patchy phase. And the question is, you know, how long it lasted and whether, you know, whether you can translate, whether it's, you know, zero or one, or you had something in between. You definitely had something in between in realistic scenarios. So that's mirror the signal somewhat and so on. So in that sense, this is a toy model, but it will be, there will be some inhomogeneous phase, some patchy phase like that.
Can I think of this toy model as sort of being fluctuations in the angular fluctuations in the redshift of reionization, and RC is basically like the curvature, the typical curvature radius of that surface.
Yeah, you can think of it that way. Yeah, so the features on the reionization surface correspond in that sense to the reionization redshift, to the fluctuations in the reionization redshift.
Have you thought about making a direct computation of the likelihood function using methods similar to like Erikson when they studied the anisotropy of statistical anisotropy of fluctuations? So you have a template for the CLs, so you could conceivably just compute the likelihood likelihood function because you have a template. Do you think that you'd do better doing that than using these frequentist methods?
I don't know. I haven't thought about it. No, we just completed this project about a month ago or so. So I haven't yet delved into reionization thinking very much, but AGS deeper?
No, there's Erikson, Hans Christian.
Oh, Erikson, sorry. Okay.
They tested these models of statistical anisotropy because there's a template for the CLs. So you can just compute the likelihood function because you know the theoretical expectation given a Gaussian CMB is just diagonal, but then you have these off-diagonal correlations, so then you can just...
Oh, okay. So you mean instead of this minimum variance approach, a minimum variance estimator approach?
So that would be a more like, I don't know, Bayesian approach where you just compute the likelihood, whereas...
I see. Okay, I don't know how they compare. I haven't thought about it. No. I don't know how they compare.
All right. Well, if there are no more questions,